Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world. Well, welcome back to the Center for Internet Security's podcast, Cybersecurity Where You Are. It's great to be here solo today as the host. Sean is off doing other things, but we have a really special episode here, and you'll see more episodes dedicated to this in the next several months, but we're rapidly approaching the 25th birthday of the Center for Internet Security. So to kick us off, we're going to have a special episode here with in the entire history of the 25 years, we've had three chairs of the board, and we happen to have them all here today with us. So we're going to go through a little bit of history, talk about some of the conditions and early ideas that led to the formation of the Center for Internet Security, our growth and maturation as an organization, and then maybe a little bit of what's next all coming up. So it's a pleasure to have you join us again today. And let me introduce each in turn. If you could each take just a minute to introduce yourselves, maybe a moment about your background, and then we'll dig into the conversation. I'll kick off with the distinguished Frank Reeder, a member of our board emeritus and the first chair of the board. Welcome, Frank.
Good to be here. As you can tell, I've aged a bit since I've seen most of these people. Spent 35 years in public service, variously, most of it in the executive branch, and largest chunk of that at the Office of Management and Budget and later the White House, but also spent some time on Capitol Hill. My career was sort of split between doing real things like running the House of Representatives computer center to telling other people to do good things, making policy at OMB and elsewhere. Both were fun. And my life has sort of been lived at the intersection of technology, ethics, and governance. And so the Center for Internet Security was a labor of love with Alan Paller and others 25 years ago. I continue to follow with perhaps false pride, but great pride, the great strides under Bobby and John Gilligan's leadership that the center is making.
You should take pride, Fred, because there was a lot going on. But the work that you have done, as you said, at the intersection of those various dimensions is ever more relevant today. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit. Next up is our former chair and current CEO, John Gilligan. John, welcome.
Well, Tony, thank you. It's delightful to be with colleagues and to talk about the history of the Center for Internet Security. So my background started focusing on cybersecurity when I got out of school, and then I joined the government and spent 25 years in the government, really not doing much in focused on back then computer security. It was management positions, and ended my government career having the opportunity to serve as the chief information officer of the Department of Energy first, and then the Air Force. When I retired, I went into industry and began to basically continue efforts to try to improve our systems that are provided mostly to the Department of Defense. And then I got into doing some consulting and boards, out of that has come a couple of opportunities, and including the opportunity to chair the board of the Center for Internet Security. As Frank, as I recall, Frank called me one day and said, "Hey, I'm getting to the point age-wise where I'm looking to slow down. Would you be willing to take the reins?" And I said, "Sure." And of course, I had no idea at that time what the ride was that I was signing up for, but obviously spent the last, I guess it's been, almost 15 years, involved either as the chair of the board or the CEO, and it's been a great ride.
Yeah, excellent salesmanship there, Frank, by the way. You sold the job masterfully to John, but I'm not sure any of us could have predicted what that last 15 years would have looked like. So it was
great to have you at the helm there. And then last but not least, a longstanding colleague, friend, and the current chair of the board, Bobby Stempley. Bobby, welcome.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate the opportunity. And John, I have a very similar story. I got a phone call from Frank one day while I was crossing the street. And he said, hey, how would you feel about? And that was my introduction to the board there as well. So I've learned over the years that when Frank calls and asks you to do something, it's always an interesting ride and well worth the time. So thank you. thank you for that. So I have several decades in digital transformation and cybersecurity related topics across all dimensions. I spent 23, almost 24 years in the federal government across several departments. I was the CIO of a major defense agency, and then was the Deputy Assistant Secretary and Acting Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security over the Office of Cybersecurity and Communications, which is a legacy organization now, CISA, well, 3/4 of CISA as it's currently instantiated, and then spent time working for research organizations and nonprofits, and so have that part of public sector, both directly for government, public sector in the nonprofit community, and now am in industry, really looking for roles that are about making an impact at scale and trying to increase the security, safety, and stability of this digital environment that's so impactful to our lives.
Yeah, great stuff, Bobby. Great background also. So we'll run through some questions here, but let's go where the conversation takes us, because we're all old friends here, and the theme of the Center for Internet Security has been something that we've each touched at multiple points in our careers. So Frank, I'm going to start with you, because you were there for day zero for the legendary meeting at the Cosmos Club. Could you set the stage for the audience with the context? What was the conversation, right? What was the perception of the problem and what needed to get done?
Well, at that time, we're talking about the summer of 2000. As someone said in a later meeting that I think Bobby and I were both at that time, the problem was getting people to understand that there was a problem. Today, that's not a problem anymore. That's not the challenge. But essentially, the origin of the concept of the Center for Internet Security was, as most good ideas, those of us on the screen have been associated with, came from Alan Power. Alan was convinced that the state of the practice of cybersecurity was woefully inadequate, and largely because there were a lot of people. I think the metaphor I've used in the past is it was like 19th century medicine. Lots of people out there practicing, a small percentage of whom had any idea what they were doing. And so the concept actually came up at a breakfast that Alan and Jeffrey Hunker and I had. How do we share that knowledge? And we'll keep coming back to his name, as Alan understood, and I've come to understand, the answer is not to try to sell your solution, but to socialize it with a whole bunch of really smart people, the result of which is that the idea gets even better and really good people will then own it and advocate for it. And so Alan went to his electronic Rolodex and we invited a couple of dozen people to a dinner at Cosmos to brainstorm. I believe John was there. I think a bunch of really smart folks helped us hone the idea of what CIS was to become. But essentially, we came away from that meeting with three questions that needed to be addressed. The first was, what is good practice? That is, what do I need to do to secure my cyber infrastructure? The second was, how much is enough? I mean, what would constitute due diligence? Every enterprise wasn't going to look like your former employer, Tony, and it probably wasn't necessary for them to be. And the third question is that we've addressed in other ways, not largely through CIS, was, how do I know whom to trust? who knows what he or she is doing and who doesn't.
Yeah, so the basic concept, right, was worked through at the meeting, and that this notion of gathering experts as opposed to hiring experts, you know, in a singular place. And I think that resonated. John, you come from the traditional government background, large agency, lots of resources or whatever. But what did you think of the idea or the notion of this community building outside of government, really looked at what it traditionally meant a government concern?
Well, yeah, I think the sense that I had back then was that we as a nation had a major problem. And I'll maybe just share a vignette. My first encounter with Alan Paller was right around this same time. Alan had invited me to speak at a press conference. And my message at the press conference, the key message was that the software systems that were being provided by the vendors were so insecure that I was paying more money to patch and fix the software than I was to buy the software, and I would gladly pay more money for a higher quality product. And so that led to a series of subsequent discussions, and ultimately in the Air Force, we actually undertook, you know, what we today in CIS called a benchmark, and we deployed across the Air Force. So to your question, I think it was very clear that there needed to be support provided to the many organizations who were using the commercial software, because the products that we were getting were not secure and were likely not going to be secure for a while.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, again, there was kind of an assumption, right? The Defense Department is big and bad and has lots of resources. But, you know, I remember seeing those headlines, by the way, John. I'm not sure if we knew each other back then, but I thought, oh, this guy's got it figured out, because that was the problem that we were dealing with from inside government. But Bob, you were part of that late 90s. You know, I look back at that kind of 98, 99, 2000, kind of there. That was the rapid rise of understanding the configuration management of IT at scale really mattered as a security problem. So, you know, you were working that directly, right, at DISA. And did you have, when was your sort of first knowledge of CIS or the rise of a nonprofit partner?
It's really interesting, because what was happening at the time really was the defense, right? We thought in the Defense Department that we could solve this problem for the Defense Department. I know there are like many, many iterations of this situation. And I would say, I'm not sure we appreciated from inside the government the value of nonprofits in this space at the time. We have a history of technology that needs to be built so that it can be something, whatever anyone wants, whenever they want it, in a way that, is enabling those end users. And that, I think, created the need for these configuration guides, these benchmarks, these things that could be very specific and unique to large organizations, but could also be useful and helpful to smaller organizations, right? So that we could say, no, these things are too risky. It should be off the table for this to be a standard default configuration. And really, I think that was, the recognition of that was too late in coming across the industry. I think that's there. But I think the other thing that's been too late in coming is really the recognition of the value of nonprofits in the technology landscape, not just today, but going forward. You think about the internet as it exists today and how much of it is dependent on volunteers and nonprofit organizations in order to be successful. And CIS is just one of a phenomenal set of examples in that space. And I think the more that we can do to help people recognize the value of these incredibly important gems of organizations in just the everyday operation and design and capabilities of this technology, I think is incredibly important.
No question. And, you know, we certainly come to appreciate it, you know, in our post-government careers and being part of, one of the thriving nonprofits. But yeah, let me address my first connection to the Center for Internet Security through the same person, of course, Alan Paller. And, you know, there was a bit of a, I'll call it a myth. You know, NSA has plenty of resources to analyze, understand, and come up with great recommendations. And we had a lot of resources, you know, as good as there was in the government. I think that would be fair. But I remember distinctly, and many of you knew a fellow named Paul Bartok. So he eventually became the tech lead of the blue team at NSA, which was the producer of the NSA security guides, the equivalent of a CIS benchmark or DISA STIG. And we had a very successful Windows NT security guide that was shared with DISA, with the government, all that. And Paul leaned into my office one day and he goes, you know, Windows 2000 is coming. And, you know, here's the number. He knew exactly how many registry settings and recommendations were in the Windows NT guide. And he said, Windows 2000 will be, you know, go from hundreds to thousands, something kind of one of that order. I don't think we can keep up. And by the way, Windows NT isn't going anywhere for another decade in the DoD. So we have to keep the old version up while we deal with the new version. What are we going to do? And I said, boy, Paul, make me a list of everybody in the U.S. government that has a Windows NT security guide, and we'll call them and see if they want to work together. And so that started, you know, my thinking about this. Well, it turned out most of that list evaporated literally in an afternoon, because government's pretty good at getting excited about something, getting started, and then moving on to the next thing. And so a lot of things were no longer funded. Missions had changed. But I had a notion. I had met this fella, Alan Powler, you know, some months earlier, and we had spoken a few times, weren't close or anything, but I just called him out of the blue. And because I was aware of something called the SANS Windows NT step-by-step guide, which was right in the, you know, domain of this kind of thinking, basically said, Alan, what are you going to do about Windows 2000? He said, I don't know. What are you going to do? I said, I don't know, but let's do it together. And he said, well, let me introduce you to this guy, Clint Kreitner, that we've just hired. And it turned out he was employee number one when there was exactly one employee. And so that started, you know, my association there. But the way I convinced my boss, actually boss's boss, a fellow named Mike Jacobs, was the information assurance director at the time, was, you know, we don't have enough resources to deal with all of it, but we could partner with a nonprofit. And we could also provide specific expertise. And I'll say it gently. We had crypto mathematicians on every street corner at NSA who could deal with the crypto issues beautifully. But we didn't have people across the range of technologies that were important for the department. So that partnership was perfect from my point of view. So Frank, let me come back to you, though, on the business model of CIS. So I remember talking to Clint early, and he said, Tony, his line was this, Tony, I've never run a business where we give our best product away for free. And you've often quipped about the struggles to find the business model that was sustainable and powerful enough, right? And in fact, here we are 25 years later. So tell us a little about your thinking there and what you observed.
Well, I think I've said it before. As a consequence of wrestling with that dilemma, we spent the first year worrying about cash flow. My conversations with Clint almost every week began with how far are we from falling off the cliff? And the problem was severalfold. One was we sensed that we had to be a not-for-profit in order for the smart people in government to be able to participate. Having been in government, that was a given. But we had a further dilemma because the people most likely to give us money were people whose products we would be, in a sense, evaluating. And so that put a further constraint on the flow of money. We would not... for example, our first benchmark was Sun Solaris, and we knew that Windows operating systems would be in the queue next. So we couldn't take money from Sun or Microsoft, the people with the deepest pockets. And we ultimately settled on what I call the NPR or church model, if you will, if you prefer a secular approach. We were convinced, and it turned out to be the case before the merger with the ISAC, that enough people would be willing to contribute, or enough organizations would, to keep us alive, because we were not, as you pointed out, likely to become a very large organization. Our model was that the intellectual capital would be contributed along with modest sums that would cover overhead administrative costs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that notion, right, of this community value created by a community of volunteers, and then the sustainment of it. Again, having dealt with dozens and dozens now of other nonprofits, it's just amazing how well that has worked out. And I know there were some lean early years in there, but between the sort of community goodwill, but also the notion of creating content that is made available and paying for support and licensing of the content through vendors to make it more broadly available in the marketplace has really been.
If I may briefly, one of the questions I've always had, and I don't know, perhaps we've done it since, we never actually put a dollar value on the contributions we got. I mean, the revenue in terms of intellectual contribution of our members far exceeds the dollars that they gave us to run the place.
Yeah, I often say you can benefit from people you couldn't afford to hire, right, through the products of CIS. And, John, Bobby, we can name many of those early volunteers, Randy Marchini and folks like that, how prominent and amazing people. And I've spoken to many of them in the last couple of years, and all of them point back to this time in their careers, one of the highlights, being part of this community, again, creating the content, but also, providing products and services, especially for those who can't really afford the commercial marketplace and making that available. So, John, you've seen this from multiple viewpoints. I mean, you've touched Center for Internet Security, and you played a key role in one of the major component parts, the critical security controls, as running the consensus audit guideline project. But so you've both been chair, thanks to the excellent salesmanship by Frank, but also CEO. What did you see as the chair in terms of the potential of CIS, and what, as you transitioned to the CEO, what did you focus on? That is, what did you think was possible?
And when I initially took over as chair, CIS was a pretty small organization. And I'll never forget, it was only a few months after I took over as chair, the discussion at one of the board meetings was, we got a couple $100,000 in the bank. Let's look at acquisitions. That led to the absorption, I guess is the best term, acquisition of the multi-state ISAC, which had it really grown out of New York State, and New York State, was interested in, encouraging them to find a different home. That put us on a trajectory because we started then getting funding from the government, and that funding increased over time. And so, my initial thought was, as Frank described, we'd keep this relatively small and we would continue to deploy best practices, and we'd have enough money to be able to cover the, six employees that we had at the time. And but it sort of took off with the MS-ISAC initially. And then what ended up happening is in 2013, 2014, we also started to add additional products that we were providing. We had been providing some through the funding from the federal government, but the state and local folks wanted more. And so that sort of created the notion of us being a product deployer, and sales became important. And that actually put the company on a totally different trajectory. As Frank said, initially when the company was founded, it was like a lot of nonprofits. We were looking for people to, donate who would see value. And, what we've evolved to is a totally self-funded organization that of significant size. And having worked in private industry, I will tell you there are enormous advantages to having that as a model, in terms of it gives us flexibility to take on problems that others wouldn't be willing to take on because they can't find the right sponsor. So I'll stop there, but that's sort of what I would say has been the evolution. And right now that continues to be the path that we're on.
If I can, what I think is so prescient about that decision is that it put the organization in a position to have the same experience as many of our customers as well, right? So it had an operational function, as a data analysis function, it has a consensus activity. And so it gave CIS sort of this 360 view that not the ISAC didn't have on its own, and the CIS organization before the ISAC didn't have. And you know, when that elixir happens, it's, you know, it's real magic. And I think it's really enabled an opportunity to understand the totality of the ecosystem in a way that allows CIS to continue to punch far above its, you know, its size in terms of impact.
No, I think you're exactly right, Bobby. And, you know, so quick anecdote. So when I spun the critical controls out of SANS and a tiny little nonprofit formed with Jane Lute. And then she and Will, you know, she came back from a meeting with Will Pelgrin, who was the CEO at the time, and said, Will and I were talking. It sounds like we're going the same place. And we were wondering, maybe we should just go there together. What do you think? I said, sounds good to me. And so I remember we pulled up in a cab, pre-Uber, as I recall, in front of the headquarters there, you know, out in East Greenbush, New York. And Jane and I pull up and we step out. And I realized, and I said to Jane, oh, I get it. I know. This was perfect. We have an operational mission now. And that's that synergy, right, between, you know, what John talked about and what you mentioned, this idea of, and it felt right because it was similar to what we were doing, you know, Bobby, you and I, right, with STIGs and NSA guides and, you know, supporting folks like John. We're not writing term papers or academic, you know, thought pieces about better security. We're defining operational management practices. And you want to get those right. And to get them right, like with the state and locals, as John talked about, you have to understand the operational environment. You have to know what their constraints are, right? Both in terms of technology, the attack surfaces, but also the cost constraints and the policy issues they have to deal with. So that holistic look that you talked about, Bobby, is exactly right. And I think, you know, it took us a while to sort of pull all that and see it. And I often describe the third leg of that is we are a big time IT company, right? I'm big time for several hundred people, but you know, worldwide presence, lots of complicated partners. So we live this. You know, we live it on behalf of tens of thousands of state and local governments. We live it as an enterprise, and we are professional advice givers, you might say, for the entire world. So that, yeah, I don't think that was, you know, and it worked out the way apparently it was supposed to work out, right? It's so neatly put together. So Frank, you know, again, the original thought was when I first I met employee number one when there was one person, but I always thought of CIS as like a 10-person company. And then, you know, I knew that ISAC, you know, had become part of it, but that growth now over just the last several years, when Jane and I came on board, I think we were still two digits in number of employees, and now we're somewhere in the 500 range. But so Frank, what do you see as you look back on CIS? I mean, is this part of the vision? Is it consistent? Or, you know, what do you think the potential, you know, what have we realized and what are we missing here?
Yeah, my facetious answer would be, of course, we foresaw.
You had to predict it. Excellent. I'm going to put that on the record.
That's my story. And in fact, it's completely inaccurate. Part of the lesson here is being selectively opportunistic. And John, by this point, was in the lead, and he was exactly the right person to do that. And so he can speak better to how the integration occurred. But quite frankly, no pun intended, there, you know, we saw ourselves as a very small organization. In fact, one of the things that we were concerned about at the time was that what we wanted to do was amplify and distribute what the community was already developing and not become a competitor. And so all that's occurred in the last 12 to 14 years, certainly, at least from my recollection, would have been beyond our imagination.
And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break.
Operating systems in the cloud are vulnerable to malware, misconfiguration, and more. That is, unless you securely configure them. Enter the CIS Ardent Images. These virtual machine images come pre-hardened to the CIS benchmarks, providing built-in security and compliance you can trust. Available at less than 3 cents per compute hour, CIS hardened images save you time and money managing your cloud security posture. Available on all major cloud service platforms. So spin one up today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode.
Well, I think there's a sort of a consistency of the vision, you know, that you guys got down pretty well right up front. You know, this idea of community building, right, of making large scale availability of the products and services. And yeah, I don't know that we could have predicted, any of us, even you, Frank, you know, the shape it would have taken. But I feel pretty comfortable that this is consistent with the big ideas. And, you know, I think, as you said, John was the right person at the right time. And to bring those together. So when we came on board, Jane, and I would say, you know, it's impolite to say operate in stovepipes. So, you know, I stole this from somebody else. We operated in cylinders of excellence. You know, everyone was really good at what they were doing. But John, I still have my handwritten notes from your first, I think it was a all hands meeting of the workforce when you shifted to become the full-time CEO. And one of the first themes you mentioned was integration of the company. We need to operate as integrated. And I was cheering and writing check marks next to my notes of what you said there. And that was exactly right. You know, that you saw a potential that maybe wasn't clear before or hadn't been realized before. So you really did a great job of sort of bringing that together, but also overseeing the growth, right? Taking advantage of those different pieces. But I think even the way you described it, right? It was, you've often talked about opportunistic has been our model. We're not predictive, but I think having the right sort of conceptual model also created those opportunities to show up at the doorstep, right? Gave us a chance to look at things like that. But I don't know, any sort of philosophical thoughts along those lines, John? You've talked often about opportunistic.
I think, Tony, as you say, when I took over as CEO, the company was doing quite well. Will Pelgren had done a great job as the CEO. But we were operating somewhat in isolation. So you could see the folks who had come from the multi-state ISAC heritage and those that had come, you know, from the, you know, benchmark best practice heritage. And it took, as Bobby indicated, it took, you know, a few years for us to be able to see the value of those two, you know, separate organizations that sort of grew up separately, interacting. And each year since then, so, you know, probably starting in, you know, 2020, 2021, we have grown much closer to the point today that the what we call best practices is fully integrated into our operational activities. And as was mentioned, you know, the feedback that we're getting from real operational users is invaluable. And in fact, I would say that, you know, back to your earlier question, Tony, about the role of nonprofits, my thought process has evolved. You know, when I was in government, you know, as many government employees, you know, that was the center of the universe and all wisdom would flow from the government. And, you know, over time, I've now evolved to the position where, as I've watched the government struggle in trying to deal with cybersecurity issues in particular, in this case, I've come to the conclusion they are just not able, they will not be able to deal with these issues from a policy, from a solution standpoint, because of their stovepipes, because of the speed with which they operate, et cetera. And so my argument is, we must move to put greater emphasis on the private sector and organizations like CIS, who are nonprofits, to bring the private sector into a meaningful dialogue that can help us begin to change the direction, the trajectory of where we are in the cybersecurity field.
Yeah, John, I think you're exactly right. And I think we'd all share that observation because, you know, it's a reflection of both the technology, the universal, you know, connectivity that we all have, but also of the social times, right? The need for speed, the need for less top-down, you know, approaches, and frankly, more agile, right? More rapidly adapting to the conditions. So Bobby, let me give you a chance here as the most recent chairman. So what have you chosen to focus on, and what do you think is next in terms of directions?
Such a big question. I will pivot to it. Give me just a moment. I think John, sort of this conversation about where and how the ecosystem of players evolves. When we think about the government and it needing to do what the tasks it's assigned by its citizenry and in a way that the citizenry understand. And then the market industry, the market gets what the market demands. And so the gap between those two, I think, is the key place where nonprofits and CIS in particular just really shine in its ability to demystify, to bring to the table both demand to drive the market in ways that's necessary and to fill goals. It's been the sort of the legacy of CIS, and I think the future of the organization is figuring out what that looks like over the next 10 years, right? When opportunity benefits the prepared, what do we need to be prepared for in that space? I think CIS is such a treasure. And when I had the privilege of joining the board and then of becoming its chair, I really, really came to understand it even more and really value it even more. And so that means that, you know, job one was to make sure that the organization had the sort of stability, the footing that it needed so that I could look Frank in the face and say, you know, we've taken care of this treasure that's there and that could live up to the ideas and the vision that Alan and others had on the table. And then I think about these waves of technology transformation that we've all lived through, right? We talked about the late 90s and really the emergence of connectivity and how that transformed things, the digitization of all of our lives in some way or form. And so what is it that this organization needs to be prepared for? Because there'll be new iterations of that technology transformation and the products and services that the organization delivers have to live in this moment where our underserved communities aren't quite evolving at the pace of the industry items. But engagement with industry is how we change the world for even those underserved. And then any organization that achieves 25 has done a phenomenal set of things, but also could suffer from founder's folly, right? Nonprofits and the private sector are fundamentally different. I understand that. But when I think about the number of companies that were public companies that existed 25 years ago and whether they exist today, what does that look like? And the sort of evolution of technology, wanting to be sure that CIS has got a foundation and doesn't fall into that founder's folly problem, thinking that the future will always look like the past. I keep those top of mind in every day in my conversations and interactions.
We absolutely appreciate that, Bobby, because so far for 25 years, again, this is really quite an extraordinary run and incredible growth and something to be really proud of, you know, thanks to you folks and lots of others. But it's also, it's not guaranteed. And so being aware of the unique role of nonprofits, the ability to, you know, what are the core strengths or the real enduring value that we bring to the marketplace. And that can take a lot of different forms, and it has over the years, and no doubt it will for the future. So let me give us a chance to wrap up here, give you each a chance to think a little bit about your association with the Center for Internet Security. Any last thought, a minute or two, on how you feel about it, Frank? maybe what you wish for the future for us, and we'll go around starting with you, Frank.
Wow. To paraphrase Bobby, a big question. The crown jewels of CIS, it seems to me, are its independence and its emphasis on excellence. And third, again, referring to Alan, its focus on impact, that is, producing interesting products is not in and of itself the purpose. It is their uptake, as the Brits would call it, and having a serious impact on, and predicting what the next wave will be is certainly beyond my limited skill set. But I think the work that was done early on that John and Bobby have continued to foster, we haven't lost that. We haven't lost that sense of being a neutral player at the same time being a really smart neutral player.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. You're very modest about your role in setting that tone from day zero, literally, for the center. We appreciate it, and again, I think we're all conscious of, you know, of that. You know, we have, all of us have lives in public service, you know, of one type or another, and I think that we appreciate the chance to continue it here at the Center for Internet Security. So, John, how about you? You've overseen this incredible period of growth and huge impact. And really a national leadership role for the Center for Internet Security. So any last thought?
Adding to what Frank described, put emphasis on, is we haven't talked yet about the culture of CIS, which is extraordinarily important. This organization is different than any organization I've worked with or for. And that's really important. It's important to our people, and it sort of helps us focus. And the focus is on the making an impact on the customer. And what I have been most proud has been, as we look in the rearview mirror, what has guided us has been what's the need, and where can we have greatest impact. And so, you know, today, for example, we're looking at the critical infrastructure area and recognizing that that's a major challenge. But our lens is, and we're working with other companies, our lens is that the products that are often being provided by the traditional vendors, they're not well tailored to, as Bobby said, sort of the side, we call them the cyber underserved. And what we bring is an understanding of their needs. And our objective is to, as we have done with other products that we have deployed, is to work with them to tailor their products so that they can be effective. They can be reasonably cost effective. They can be efficient, and they can be easily used. And so I think that type of kind of thought leadership and influencing industry is what I would see, you know, and again, leveraging the very just outstanding culture that has been developed is the future.
No, that's a great catch, John, this mission-driven opportunity, and that, you know, pervades the workforce, and coupled with business success, that allows us to focus on some of these larger problems that can't be, that, you know, aren't of interest directly to the commercial marketplace, may not make sense for federal government or state governments to take on by themselves, is really an incredibly powerful niche. And we're often counter to the market, you know, market in marketing speak, right? More features is better for many of the, especially state and local governments. More features is just more features, more confusion, more complexity, more things to go wrong, and really do not meet the needs. And so, you know, us able to kind of work in that space and to understand that environment, but also tailor the solutions to help folks who couldn't do it on their own. It's just incredibly important. But I love the culture mention, because again, the tone was set from, I think, the first meeting and the first employee and everybody that I knew in those early days. And I mentioned the volunteers who still proudly look at their time at CIS, you know, guys who have great commercial businesses, look back proudly to their time and see it as community service. Okay, Bobby, we'll let you close out as the current chair.
First off, thank you for the conversation. Anytime I have the opportunity to share the stage with these gentlemen, it's you know, always worth the time and energy. I would say, I start everything I think about, every interaction I've had with CIS from the past until now, being being affiliated with the board is about that impact. And so I really think about the organization across three dimensions. John touched on culture and people certainly being important. Impact happens because of culture and people. I've worked with some amazing people over my career, smart folks in research organizations and government and others, but I can say the team at CIS is among the best that I've ever known. And their commitment to the mission, their clarity of purpose, and their expertise, whether it be technical about the technology or about the mission or about the business areas of their customers, it's on display every day. Are the partners and volunteers of the organization. The organization scales. People don't scale, but this organization scales through working with other experts. And CIS has always had impact beyond its size, whether it was 1, 2, 6, or in the almost 500 or just over 500 now. It happens because of those partners. Some of those partners are government, US and internationally. Some are industry experts. Some are just brilliant individuals who want to give in that space. And so those partners helping with the benchmark, state and local partners helping being members of the ISAC or helping us understand that situation, international fora, that partnership, people want to be associated with this organization and that partnership. So early partners you identified, but even the today, right, volunteers and others, just speaks to the credibility and the value of the organization. And then I think the final statement about the credibility and value is in its customers. And the credibility, I think, of any organization is measured in how it provides unparalleled value to its customers. And it isn't easy because I had a colleague who I think is at CIS now. I worked with it at DHS who told me, if you've ever seen one state, you've been to one state. That, you know, there are 50 of them, 6 territories, 3,000 counties, and you know, everybody is somewhat, it's just a little different. And the ability to understand and juggle all of those, it isn't easy. And CIS does it flawlessly, day after day, because of that commitment to that mission and making that impact.
Yeah, great observation and great wrap up for the audience there. So anyway, so we're going to celebrate 25 years of impact. Looking forward to many more. As you said, Bobby, this is an extraordinary opportunity to talk to some of the most amazing people in this industry. So I appreciate it. Frank, thank you for getting us off to a great start. John, you really helped us grow and a great steady hand as the CEO. And Bobby, you know, all you got to do is top all that. Nothing to it. It'll be great. But it's been a pleasure, and I know we all feel the same as those of us, at least, well, those of us that are still working, to be associated with CIS is just an amazing opportunity. Incredibly impactful, great fun, and a continuation of lives in public service. So thanks to all three of you. Thanks to all of our friends, allies, employees, and all the folks that we deal with here. So really appreciate it. Looking forward to catching you again another time. We'll talk some more about the implications of the future of CIS as we ponder our 25th birthday, celebrate, and challenge ourselves to do even better. So for the audience, thank you for your time and attention. We went a little long today, but it was absolutely worth it. This has been a chance for us to think about where we came from and what's next for us. So as always, subscribe to us in the usual ways. We appreciate your time and attention and look forward to you joining us in the next episode of Cybersecurity Where You Are. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.